Confusion matrix.
One thing I'd like to front this with is saying I don't believe in fake it until you make it, and I think that applies to everything. I think it's an ethos. I think it's awful. There's no excuse now not to make something.
Yeah.
And, you know, back to our theme du jour, data and begetting innovation, you can see where companies have built things in a fake till you make way and how dangerous it is and how wasteful it is and how it, puts so many, the reputation of people and actually, if you look at the healthcare sector, people's lives, frankly, at risk.
And as per usual, we are rolling. Hello again, Pete. This is a very auspicious occasion.
Yes.
Since for the first time in God knows how long, we are occupying the same physical space.
Yeah. What is going on?
We usually occupy the same virtual mind. but the physical space is an unusual one.
Yeah.
Since we live at opposite ends of the country. Well, I'm down in deepest, darkest, dirtiest Buckinghamshire, which
that's
is
so dirty.
Yes, the opposite side of London from where I was the last recording we did, which was Essex.
Yeah,
well, so I'm a well-travelled guy. I demonstrated my disastrous wire situation to you earlier.
Yes, indeed.
It played out exactly how I said it would.
Exactly.
And so, basically, I'm very consistent, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Right. So, why are we in darkest Buckinghamshire? We are in Buckinghamshire.
It is Bucks.
Yes, it is. I grew up in Bucks. I should know. one of my old haunts, Amersham. And we are here with a very, very special celebrity guest. none other than the world-famous Ian Preston Esquire. I don't know. What are you? Bill S. Preston Esquire.
Indeed.
Wild Stallions. We're going to do a gig. Let's do. You've got a guitar over there. We should
actually
do it.
We
can jam. We can jam. Right? So this is the first time we've ever had guests on here in our, 3 month lifespan so far. Because basically, we've run out of things to say and we need to get someone else on. So we've invited Prez because we go a while back. Prez, who is currently opening a non-alcoholic beer.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to try a little three-way, a little menage a trois. And
steady, Alex.
Yes, indeed.
A lot of things going in Bucks, but not that.
Well, no, it's much too civilized here, isn't it? More like Essex, where I was before. Put that on there.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Hey, there's you protecting my kit.
Yeah, exactly. Well, where's your coaster?
The makeshift coaster is Hengist of Woodcroft. What do you call it? Card from Harry Potter.
Oh, wow!
Which you get with the chocolate toads from the
right.
From there, it's quite cool, actually. Isn't it?
Oh. Right. Well, look. This is where this is going. We're going to digress a lot. and therefore I didn't even really bother to set an agenda for this because I knew it would be blown up in minute one. So I'm going to let Prez introduce himself, and we are probably going to try and theme this around data and innovation, why I suppose will become clear. And we may well talk about that, but we may well get off into HP Lovecraft again. I don't know.
well, you certainly have to explain what on earth was going on with the HP Lovecraft coding language.
Well, that was in the last episode we recorded.
Oh, right.
Which you can't have heard because we haven't released yet.
Yeah. Right. What's
the
space?
Well,
I saw it in action today, so spoiler alert, it's mental.
Yeah, it will ruin your life.
Yeah.
So, right, in talking about ruining lives, Prez, do you want to give us a bit of an intro. Who are you?
How do I
know you?
Why are you here?
Yes.
So, well, for a long time I had to doff my hat to you, Alex, because you were a client.
I know, which makes me more important than you.
Yeah, exactly. You're my first incarnation. That's why you're on a higher stool than me now.
Yeah.
Well, and I am sitting in a...
Know your place.
Oh, yes, exactly. So we first met when I was at LBI.
Which is a
founding father of the digital industry, if you like, a founding agency body of much celebrated digital individuals, entrepreneurs and wizardry that happened around that time, a wonderful place that I enjoyed inhabiting for, 7 or 8 years or so, I think it was. So that was in the mid-2000s when we first encountered one another. I was a lowly bag-carrying client services lad.
Oh, yes.
So I was probably doffing my hat, bringing you sandwiches, taking you for beers. and at that point in time, we were brought together by the incredible project that was Trade Space.
Yes.
Which was BT's small business, kind of B2B2C platform at the time, which had the promise of bringing together kind of like a Roman forum for small businesses and, how they would coordinate and collaborate with one another online to then provide services. So your carpenters and your plumbers and so on, but then kind of building these kind of micro communities around them as well. Unfortunately, it was around the dawn of Facebook almost, and also was inherently flawed because no one in BT Consumer would get behind it and give it loads of promotion on the main biggest trafficking website in the UK. Yes. So it was flawed. But as a project and as a relationship, it was brilliant. We actually worked formal 6-day weeks, which sounds insane now.
Yeah.
When you think that as we are talking about data innovation in this episode, we ran that program as a pure properly agile program, properly agile, backlog, story pointed, the whole bit, wasn't it?
Wow.
Well, Pete here, in a former life, was a scrum master.
Yeah. Ah, there you go.
That's quite early then to really get into that.
2008.
Yeah, yeah,
2008, 2009. And the thing about it was, I say we run it as a pure scrum project, that's a bit of a fallacy, right? Because the reason we had to work a 6-day week is we ran it as a scrum project, but with a minimum final output that had to be achieved for a go-to-market release.
Yeah.
So our wiggle room in that was, well, what does the feature set look like to be able to enable a minimum viable product to go live? And actually, frankly, it was a bloody maximal viable product by the end of it.
We just kept on adding stuff on. Right?
Yeah, I mean, it just kept adding and kept growing. I had to migrate the whole fucking thing from the old service, which was a catastrophe of a thing to do because there was so much manual lifting that was involved in it. And then we were at the mercy of the insane... like BT Security Services at the time, which changed radically over the period. And again, shout out to the BT teams that we did work with and built great relationships with. But they unfortunately were working within some very arcane constraints around security protocols. And do you remember them insisting on us encrypting every piece of communication that internally ran around the system?
Do I remember? I was the one doing the paperwork, mate.
Yeah.
Right?
And then we went into a beta live state with the users, and we told them what we're going to happen. We're going to, this platform is going to be so fucking slow because literally every single piece of data that's passing around the system is going by some kind of encrypted pathway through your systems. It's going to take forever.
Yeah.
No. Set it live. It's going to be fine. Went live. Everyone complained.
Yeah.
Bar no one. And it was like, there you go. There's, we're trying to build, faith in this newly migrated service with all these features. And, it was very, very hard work.
Firstly, anyway, I was head of technology for that project. It was my fault.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't your fault. You were bound by those things, and unfortunately, but then actually, you know, sanity reigned through, and we got all that stuff removed, and it worked really effectively. Unfortunately, the business proposition was flawed. So back to that's how we got to meet each other, and then soon after that, there was a little fallow period, and then lo and behold, I'm walking through the office, and I see Alex sitting up at the far end of the building, and I'm like, "Oh right, hey man, how are you? What brings you back into these corridors?" He's like, Working, how am I? What? I'm the head of data now. And we were brought back together, and it was one of those very, very happy, like Nexus career points as well, right? Because it came at a time when our business then was really starting to go in a more serious fashion into data.
Mm-hmm.
And not just trying to make fancy swishy dashboards, although we did sell fancy swishy dashboards.
Of course.
But really trying to thoughtfully think about that, you know, that connection point from customer experience through like media presented data, because LBI had a media team back in the day,
mm-hmm.
And how you would take that kind of insights that you could gain traditionally that were just used around media campaign planning and so on,
yeah.
But then deploy those in other contexts. So whether those were commercial contexts, whether those were planning contexts and strategy contexts, I don't think it would be fair for us to say that we'd really bridged it into the creative space at that point in time. But, you know, I think certainly that bridge into strategy and how you would set about both using data as a means to learn and hypothesize about what you might do next,
yeah.
Versus just using data as so we've done a bunch of shit, have we made more money? Or yeah, how many people have we had to the website, right?
This was sort of the dawning of the Adobe platform off the back of Omniture. So this was before the concept of the fully connected digital data space and like digital stalking as a wholesale commodity we were talking about the fact that they were towards the end of that they were going to do mouse tracking type web analytics,
yeah.
And everyone was like, "You can't do that." And now Alexa's like listening to you have sex.
Alexa's literally listening to us now, and he's going to be recommending his shit based on this conversation.
Yeah, and that was considered sharp intake of breath at that point.
Yeah,
but we were at the vanguard of that for our sins.
Well, also at the vanguard of actually. The thing that is still one of the stumbling blocks of many data lake related products. I haven't heard that term in a while, but you know what I mean? I was in a conversation a couple of weeks ago with somebody, and they mentioned the word orchestration, which is something that we used to talk about an awful lot, which kind of fell away from fashion.
Yeah.
And now it's back in vogue where people are talking about data orchestration again, you know, and how you would have, you know, safe havens for data cleansing and all that kind of stuff. We actually, our teams, you know, again, shout out to the old LBI North America team here as well, built some of those first implementations using early LiveRamp and all that kind of stuff. And do you remember back then, because this was pre-Trade Desk existing and all those kind of things, but we were using the geotags on cable boxes, right, as one of the ways of us joining data, so that we could achieve greater levels of insight and targeting and stuff.
Yeah.
And then obviously then you back that away and anonymize it and everything like that. So you're obviously we took mobile ad data, Nielsen panel data, a bunch of other stuff, wasn't it? All kinds of things. And then created these new audience groups, kicked out to LiveRamp, had this like safe harbor thing with Experian or whatever the fuck it was then, and then brought it back in an anonymized fashion. But some of those segments, I mean, it's really fucking cool stuff with it back then, really cool. And even as a research tool, it was so much more insightful because back then you had, your Nielsen groups, and it's like, well, are you fucking bias abound, right? You know, like just because these panels of the average American household or whatever, like, and then you looked at real behavior. And we did one for a mobile phone company, and they were astonished by what we could simulate as a customer journey.
Yeah.
About what people did. Like, for example, high value purchase and what you needed for reassurance post sale.
Yeah.
So actually the number of people who, when you buy a shiny mobile phone, instinctively the first thing you go off and do is then go to another review site to reassure yourself you made a good decision.
Yeah.
Mental, right? But actually, true. Yeah. How many times have you bought something that's really fucking expensive and then gone, yeah, click, brilliant, I'm excited about that. Oh, what have I just done? Oh, someone please tell me that was a good thing because the wife's going to kill me. Shit. Oh, yeah, look, I agree with Ferret Techie Doctor 78 in 4 and Y, you know. So what we were able to get to is using data as a means of providing new degrees of insight that meant that we could inform the customer experience far better in a, I don't want to say a predictive sense, but certainly a sense that then made your hypotheses way more robust. Yeah. And it also provoked the clients to think differently about their audiences.
Yeah.
You know, and not just go, hang on, let's just live by what Nielsen's telling us, or let's just buy an audience.
This was the dawn of A/B testing, right?
Yeah.
But the idea that you didn't have to guess, you could actually, you know, try out different user experiences and use statistics to figure out which one was the the most effective, which is now very commonplace and used terribly everywhere.
Yeah.
Right. Now we're in the world of, you know, like, you know, the amount of the kind of ad media stuff and everything like that, how much of that is bought and traded and all those kind of platforms and stuff. And what we were doing was essentially circumventing those to build our own audience groups. Or you might have circumvented the wrong term, isn't it? We used some of the data points that provided.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly didn't just go, well, that's the thing that we trust.
Yeah.
You know, and especially when it's informing, and again, let's be clear, like it was not trying to inform a media strategy. It wasn't trying to inform better targeting of advertising. It was informing a better use of your owned properties and then also a better use of your post-click data to then inform where else you should go with your media strategy.
Yeah.
So it was essentially use some of that insight that you could gain from your media strategy to inform a better owned platform customer experience to then go, this is your next best things that you should do on these other platforms that are out there.
Yeah. So I'm going to stop you, Perez.
Yeah.
Because I asked you...
That was my intro.
Yeah, you were supposed to intro. And you haven't even told us what you do.
As of now, I'm an independent. So... A year ago...
Independent what?
I'm an independent woman!
And strong.
Yeah, exactly. So I've spent 2 years ago, my role was made redundant from a big network agency.
What role? What were you doing?
I was a chief client success officer.
There you go. What does that mean?
Well, there you go. That's exactly the head-scratching question that I wanted from people when I invented the fucking title.
Oh, right.
So, I was one of those twats. I was the twat that went, I'd like this new job, but I want my own title. And I want a big brass plaque with an arm. I'll dig into that a little bit because there's a very deliberate reason that I didn't want a chief growth officer title at that point.
So just to glide past this a little bit, when you were talking about you and me working together as client, blah, 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 you were the client partner at LBI, which ultimately meant you were the most senior person there that owned the relationship with any given client.
That's where I got to.
Mm. Yes.
So at the time, I was kind of a little bit more junior, but trade space, BT relationship, everything like that, built me up to that, and then I became an associate client partner.
And give me some brands.
Foot Locker, Starwood Hotels, BT, Vodafone, AstraZeneca, and then following on from that, I became a client partner in Publicis Group, where I was the global client partner, GCL, global client leader for the Sanofi relationship. So I kind of segued out of consumer brands, everything like that, via a role in as head of alliances. So I headed up alliances for the UK. So got to, you know, really work very closely with the likes of HP, Oracle, Adobe.
Keep dropping the names, although I did last thing.
And then did my publicist job, and then I went to work for RGA, and I was on the board at RGA for a year.
Right, so we'll go to RGA. Mm. We're going to jump back to AstraZeneca.
Yeah,
right?
Cool.
So back to where I diverted you, RGA, swanky job title.
Well, so post RGA, I was with Wunderman Thompson. So that was the last place I landed.
Oh, got you. Sorry.
And that's where I got a job title. But it's worth saying that RGA, kind of not necessarily by design, but by default, I ended up with I'd started in a client, an EMEA client service executive role, mm-hmm. With the board there, and then our head of growth moved back over to the States, and so at the time we said, well, actually, you know, I've done a senior BD role before and everything. And at the time I had this hypothesis about bringing kind of the tenacity of great BD people into the same
BD meaning business development, with
that kind of more long-term client relationship management kind of capability, mm-hmm. which great client services people have, and kind of fusing that together in a kind of operation, really. So that kind of was embryonic while I was with RGA. And then via a strange diversion where we sold our house, we're moving up to Yorkshire, I quit my job because I was going to, like, farm llamas in the Yorkshire Dales.
Oh, okay. Funny enough, we're not in Yorkshire.
Yeah, funny enough, I'm not in Yorkshire, and I have no llamas. I have two very, like, excitable dogs, as you guys have both met, but, like, no llamas. But, yeah, via this kind of almost midlife crisis-esque, we're off to have a small holding in Yorkshire situation, and then having to chuck that and jumped into this role at Wunderman Thompson back with my old boss, Ewan, who was Alex's old boss too. And so, no, what was great is I got the permission and also the trust from Ewan and the execs there to try out something new. And, mm-hmm. and he backed me on that hypothesis of going, look, I think there's something in forming some sort of central operation that coaches a new way of thinking about growth, business development, and how to innovate inside of client relationships to help them grow. And so the label client success officer came out of that, because my observation from the world of software was you'd had this advent of customer success officers, right? Mm. Or customer success teams, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole purpose of them was, well, people have got all this fucking software, they buy all these licenses, but then people are churning, and it's all because we don't know how they're using them and how they're helping them create value.
Yeah.
And so actually, we as this type of team is obligated to make sure that the clients get the greatest value out of that operating system that they bought.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So my analogous situation was, well, we're a big network servicing these clients with lots and lots of different types of service, whether it be Wunderman Thompson, now VML, you know, hardcore technology builds, like big stuff, right? And not a lot of people necessarily understood or recognized that. Big creative work. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the most sophisticated modern CRM and customer experience that you come across. You know, the teams out in Copenhagen and they service globally are responsible for, you know, all of Adidas's global messaging. You know, IKEA in 22 countries. Yeah. You know, really, and again, shout out to those teams and out there, because they were like using GPT-2. Back when it was first coming out, to help support in authoring content and looking at content automation tools to make their teams more efficient.
Yeah.
So they were really pioneering at that point in time. Yeah, so I was very privileged to be alongside them while they were doing that. Anyway, so the backing that I had from that team and the management team was to go, let's experiment with that and let's set up this team differently. And our team effectively acted as kind of a combined, I guess, coach during like pitching situations. So we'd run pitches, but then we'd run alongside certain markets and coach and help and support. But then we'd also then provide them with tools, services, capabilities that would then augment their own teams to do better pitching, better conversion, understand their clients better, make more appropriate suggestions about how they were going to grow a client's business and so on. He was really successful for 93 years leading that team and loved it. And it was a bit of a bump when my time came, but hey, that's a network advertising network world. I'd been in the industry 22 years or so by then and had been very fortunate never to fall foul of restructuring that way.
But yes, that's what indeed, happened.
So roll forward a bit to the present day. I spent a bit longer than that, building the house that we're now sitting in.
Yep. Very nice, it is, too.
Thank you very much.
Very well done.
Thank you. We have incompetent builders on it to start with, so I fired them and brought in my own contractors, and now we have a house. So that took up some time. Then I took some time learning to walk again after I broke my back, and then had my skull split open by a tree and various other injuries. That kind of put paid to almost a year. And then last summer, I started to really get myself on rails and put together. I think one thing I'd like to front this with is saying I don't believe in fake it until you make it. And I think that applies to everything. I think it's an ethos. I think it's awful. There's no excuse now not to make something.
Yeah.
And back to our theme du jour, data and begetting innovation. You can see where companies have built things in a fake till you make way, and how dangerous it is, and how wasteful it is, and how it puts so many the reputation of people, and actually if you look at the healthcare sector, people's lives, frankly, at risk because people have faked it until they've tried to make it.
Yeah.
And so for me personally, I took the decision that when I launched my personal business, it was a no bullshit thing. I haven't even put the name out there in the public domain. It's a vehicle for me to do interesting work with interesting people. I've been very fortunate in the past 12 months to have done a few projects on that road. We've worked together a little bit. And it's very much about that notion that I really, really love working in the space of design, creativity, data, the emerging space of AI. And I love working with people who are trying to find novel paths to get better business outcomes. But also outcomes increasingly that I really, really care more and more about the human impact involved as well. And I think a lot of that comes from our time in DIG, which I know we're going to roll back to.
Yes.
But, I think that focus on the human effect and what it's really going to do for people is a big part of what drives me now.
Yeah, and I think you are pretty much defined in your area for the ability or the urge to think differently, the need to look at things from a different perspective. But I'm really interested to rewind back to AstraZeneca and DIG, because we want to talk about innovation. That was an organization set up for nothing else than innovation within digital, within the pharma space. And I think it was a mix. It was amazing. It was, from an outside perspective, it felt like a bit of a mixed bag. But I think that was almost by design.
Yes.
But so I'm really interested. Some of it was data oriented. Some of it was much more sort of user experience focused. Blah blah blah. But I'm really interested in, because I wasn't involved from the ground there, in how, I don't need a history of it, but like what was it? Why did you create that? And what made that different from just throwing a bunch of smart people in the room and giving them some hard problems to solve? Yeah. So I just wanted to talk us basic what it was and why and how it came about.
Yeah, that's great. And I came in year two of DIG versus year one. So I'm going to give credit to certainly the people who were the people who really set up that first year, because the first year, like any first year in doing something, is a massive learning curve. And I always felt very much that I was the beneficiary of an awful lot of hard work that, you know, people had done before me. So Lizzie Shupak, John Monks,
Lorenzo,
yeah, and Ewan Sturgeon. And the conversation came out, or the nascency of DIG. So DIG was the Digital Innovation Group, right? And the Digital Innovation Group was set up as a kind of joint venture between LBI, Digitas LBI, and AstraZeneca. And it was one of those kind of wonderful serendipitous moments where Paul Hudson, the then, I think was he was on what's called SETS, so the senior executive team, who were effectively the operating board for AstraZeneca. I forget which domain he was working in, whether it was a category or a region, but anyway, Paul, super senior board, but with a really real focus on how can we innovate more effectively in places outside of the drug pipeline. Mm-hmm. You know, by our very nature, we're a business that is about discovering fucking molecules, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
We are literally, the Santa Maria navigated, finding the new world, whatever, right? Yeah. And it's like, how are we not doing that in every area of our business? That was his kind of, I guess, MO. Met Ewan Sturgeon, our boss, and they had a bit of a conflab together. And he actually set us a brief that was, you could have just taken as a straightforward brief. And this is where I think innovative thinking comes through in, it's how it was just in the DNA of what was going on at LBI full stop, mm-hmm. right? And the great thing about it was Ewan had that conversation. Paul went, look, I'm just going to try and give you a problem that I've got and see what you come back with.
Right.
And the problem was basically we spend fortunes sending reps along to medical exhibitions. And if I was in a really complete blue sky world, right? If I could just experiment with cutting off all that budget and see what impact it had on the downstream of the business, I'd just do it. Mm. Right, bang, switch it off. What happens?
Yeah.
You know, do we start losing revenue? What is it there for? Because I can't find anybody in my business who can prove to me what value that money in there does to there.
Yeah.
Right? And so he kind of threw that out there, and it was basically like, well, what are you going to, what could you do as our innovation partner to help us think through that problem? And so the team came back with their first idea of what that could be. Which they expressed in a really smart way, because the way they did it, instead of going, here's your answer and here's a cost for a proposal for a budget and here's what you need to do, they were stepped back from the situation and went, well, if this is one of the things that you have identified, I think it's fairly early on in this part of this job, then our belief is there's probably 100 of these things and you could uncover them everywhere. And if there's 100 of those things, which are business process improvement, operational, whatever, there's probably also hundreds more in opportunities that you could derive from spaces around other activities that you're doing that touch the customer, that touch the patient, that touch the doctors around and so on. Mm-hmm. So actually, instead of selling you the answer to that one thing, we're going to show you a little bit of how you might get to that answer. Mm. And actually what we're going to show you as well is a repeatable and robust way that you could find and experiment with tackling more of those challenges. Mm. And this is what it is. And that's what became DIG. And DIG's incarnation from that point forward was, we're not going to sell you the answer to the doctor's challenge that we're going to do. We're only going to do this if you buy into the notion that this is a repeating thing and this is the first thing that we're going to pull down from our backlog of future stuff.
Yeah.
And credit to Paul, credit to you, and credit to, Renzo, Lizzie, John, etc., and those first, Ryan Worm and that first big crew, they put together that first year. Sorry, the fucking almighty Hugo Manasseh, the godfather of DIG, frankly, probably the quietest and uncredited, godfather of service design, frankly. and as Hugs as we fondly know him. But yeah, the notion that they formed this crack squad broke with all the conventions of how you ran an agency-client relationship in terms of billing, in terms of timesheets, all that fucking put aside.
Yeah.
And set about putting in an innovation process that gave us incredible access to the senior executives inside of AstraZeneca, but an unbelievable buy-in from that executive board into the trajectory of that innovation forum. And like, I know I'll throw back to you, Alex, and here we can probe into that a little bit more if you want, but like, you know, how that process worked, what we did, and, you know, the role of data and innovation through as a red thread through that kind of innovation process, because it was very much there.
You got quite, because I can keep going.
get to the data. I mean, it's just really interesting. I mean, that setup straight away has got to be really unusual in the business world in general, right? Because, you know, it's almost like dream time, because most people aren't going to just buy into something like that. You know, I want the answer. You'll give me 100 answers, but I'm not getting any now.
Yeah.
And you've got to trust in the process, which is going to uncover more and more value as we go through.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fantastic, right? But a lot of people aren't going to have faith in that.
100%, mate. And then, like, and that's, you know, again, credit to Paul for selling that into Seth, yeah. But also the importance that he put it as a, you know, page one priority inside of their business. Now, fortunately, again, back to the kind of, how sustainable innovation can take place. One of the data points that we had inside the business was I think they'd had a patent extension on one of their drugs or something like that. I believe it was a patent extension or another indication. I'm pretty sure it's patent extension on one of their major drugs, which Paul's responsible for. So on the flip side, what you also need to be able to innovate is headroom, right?
Yeah.
And you need that both from a buy-in perspective, but you also need it from a financial perspective. And what Paul could afford to do is go back to Seth and say, look, here's what I've delivered. Trust me, I back this. And by the way, the number that we're going to put around this innovation pipe looks big, but set it alongside this number that we've achieved as this. So actually, it's you know, you set that next to what we invest in finding a new molecule.
Yeah.
And here's an operation that could be finding us God knows what, you know, but let's go and give it a go. So a few things that really helped us with that innovation process. And the team set about it in year one, and we kind of codified it more in year two and beyond, right? And that was, there was a rhythm that was established with the board, which was adhered to religiously, right? The first thing was we were not guaranteed anything past the next month.
All right.
So although there was a big pot of budget, every month, every product owner was accountable to go forward to the board, which was a blend of Digitas LBI exec, AstraZeneca exec, and effectively like the DIG board as well, right? So I was a member of the DIG board alongside Jason and Hugo and so on, and Ryan. And then following on from that, obviously, Dave, who took over from Ryan when he went to RGA. So each month, that was mandated. And each month, the form of that meeting was you would go in and I'll come back to the innovation process itself. But because that was a gate every month that had to be adhered to, we had very senior people brought into that.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant that everybody prepared themselves for that in a very, very rigorous way, right? But every other part of the process was as lightweight as it possibly could be. And even for that presentation, the format that we would give to the teams to build their basis of their presentation on was only 5 slides long.
Right. Because I was thinking that's quite a big, you know, that monthly investment and just the process of running that and getting those people there and bringing loads of products and running through it. We've done it, and everyone on the knife edge because, well, next month might not happen. You know, that in itself usually involves, you know, like several hundred teams of people.
Yeah.
Just to get that working smoothly in the company, let alone actually doing anything in between.
Yeah, no. We again, it was our role and my job inside of the board. We didn't have client services people standing in the, you know, alongside or in the way of, depending on what your perspective is. I obviously like to think it's alongside or in the way of, but, you know, I only had myself and one of the client service exec inside a team of what became 90, 100 people.
Wow.
Because we absolutely made sure that our job was just to help make the process between the product ownership and the product teams as efficient as possible so that they could engage directly with the right counterparts inside of the businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we got out of the traditional agency model of going, you need three project managers, you need two client service people, you need this, you need that. Now, you had to have a particular cast of people who were very comfortable with being in that proximity with clients, which some people weren't, and it wasn't suitable for everybody.
Yeah.
But actually, what they thrived on and what the clients thrived on was that proximity. So you had strategists, creatives, technologists, hand in hand with the clients and product owners.
Yeah.
So that was the fundamental part of that. Second fundamental part of it was data, right?
Yeah.
You know, every single project, we had kind of a very evidence-based and predictive way of demonstrating value, right? Mm. So, and I'll come back to the origin of the process first so that it makes sense as we track through to the board meetings. So the first parts of the DIG process, and I think originally there was something like seven steps overall in this kind of innovation cycle, right? And it was based around the design thinking kind of handbook, right? But highly customized in the way that it actually operated.
Yeah.
So up front, you would have what was called a theme day.
Mm-hmm.
And what the team had done prior to a theme day was they had done a bit of a landscaping exercise. So we had this backlog of potentially interesting themes and areas. What was really important about it was these were not just taken from the business strategy of AstraZeneca. It wasn't like they went, right, so you're going to deliver a drug for cancer, so we need to do cancer. Right? Yes, we went into spaces that involved cancer, and specifically I worked on something to do with lung cancer and setting up a patient community. But the questions we would help them derive via looking at cultural insights from around the world. And then we would find the inflection point where AstraZeneca's business met those themes. So one of our projects went out to sub-Saharan Africa to support patients there looking at their blood pressure and the incidence of heart attacks, right? You had another project that was literally just pointed at clinical trial efficiency.
Right.
Again, the insight for that was a really fantastic piece of insight. Was on average, every day a drug doesn't make it to market. So every drug day delay, it doesn't make it to market, is $1 million in revenue.
Oh, wow.
Gone. And that's probably a conservative, that's not even a blockbuster number.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could bring forward a clinical trial by a month, you know, tens and tens of millions of
pounds.
Right? Yeah, 300 million a year or whatever it would be, right? So so it was things like that that meant we could point ourselves at certain areas of the business to then go and create these efficiencies.
Yeah.
So data as part of theme day was an input, right? Mm-hmm. So as well as people going out and these strategists and different people doing, you know, whether it's ethnographic studies, whether it was, you know, just kind of down and dirty desk research, there was a member of Alex's team or an equivalent navigating the upfront work to then determine what we should go and investigate, right? And then following on from that, once we've done that, the DIG team had established a hypothesis-led approach to everything. And it was literally taken from the HDD handbook, right? So we every time we were going and seeing how we could go out and create a thing, it was always done with a hypothesis in mind of how we would prove that it worked. And, and for some from the project, there could be several of those.
Because that was
the way that you would then build a measurement framework. And then we'd work out what we were going to measure.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, well, what can we measure and how can we report it and what's our number? It was, right, here's what we believe. Or here's a thing that we're going to go and do. here's what we believe it's going to achieve, and we'll know it's been achieving that when we see this signal.
Simple.
And every single project that went through that process had to have those. Another really important factor, which again is a big one to sign off, so a theme day was not a small investment.
No, exactly.
A theme day, forget the research that went into it, it was at least 6 to 8 weeks of build. Well, we got it, we honed it by the end of year two into 4 weeks. It was narrowed down. And obviously you get more efficient as you learn and so on. But let's call it a 6 to 8 week process to build up to that. So, and the output like was a 3 day workshop. So imagine you're talking to a client and they go, right, so how much do you want us to invest? And you're like, well, it's X hundreds of thousands of pounds. And they go, what are you delivering? Like, 3 day workshop. And you go, okay, and in that you're going to have like the products and the solution. No, no, no. We're going to come away from that with the right question to go and pursue. What? What? Come again? Yes, yes. That's exactly what we're going to do. Are you in? Are you in? You can imagine, again, the teams would have to go around and have tens of those conversations to get buy-in across the business. Again, we had this great primary interface between our dig operation and the business, who was Bob. And Bob, who was appointed around the same time that I joined Dig in year two, was like essentially the Dig ambassador around the AstraZeneca business. He'd worked in global commercial excellence for quite some time and had a really great network of people around the business and, yes, senior level executives.
Basically the nicest guy you'll ever meet.
Also amazing on voiceovers.
Really, yes. He's just really understated, really positive, really smiley, just nice. And then he had to go and deal with all these, you know, corporate Rottweilers.
And he just with the support of John, who was our main client, John McCarthy, in global commercial excellence, you had a great team there who we would go alongside, and you know our board would go alongside, and Hugo, Jason, myself, and go and meet with these potential sponsors. Because what we needed to do is, John centrally from GCE would pop, would put in an amount, but we had to go and find somebody within the business before we started to match it. So back to the successful marriage of data and innovation, right? We were marrying those things together from an agency, if you like, partner and client perspective with a client as a broker. Like in between it to form net new partnerships for every single product. So it wasn't like what happened in these kind of frankly ephemeral beta projects that were invented around about the same time, which invariably failed to produce anything of meaning and impact, because they would be given $100 million budget and then they would run away from the core business because they went, well, we want to be different. Whereas in exact kind of the exact opposite of that, we would get our seed budget, but then we would be leaning into the business from like day one, going, well, we fucking need you, right? And you need us. But we're not here like arrogantly going, oh, we're changing your business. We're the innovation guys.
Exactly.
Look at us. Come shiny, shiny.
Digital transformation.
You know, it's like, look at me in my cloak of many colours, right? You had to go into them and go, we don't know your business like you know it. What we do know is, if we don't impress upon our product owners, our teams, ourselves, and you, the interlock between the future of your business and then what we do to help you accomplish that, we'll fail. But we strongly believe that you'll also miss out on a great opportunity to get some novel perspective on some business challenges that we think we could, you could be looking at. And I think what was great for us is, with that senior level of backing, with the ability to put, frankly, a lot of our people were not what you'd term seasoned pros, right? But fucking hell, were they the right people? I mean, honestly, again, if you'd have gone, like, if you were sitting in a procurement conversation and they were like, we want your best people on, your top brains, bring us your top brains, and you'd be like, right, get all this wheel out, all the fucking grey hairs and the execs, get them all out there, put all the senior bods on it and get them. And it would have been the wrong thing to do. Now, yes, we had some very seasoned professionals in there, but what we needed was, you know, unencumbered eyes and brains and thoughts around how you did it, because we had the freedom to go, our objective here is to solve as fast as possible.
Yeah.
But really the first objective is to work out what we're going to solve for.
Yeah, yeah.
So how can you have, so we had young minds in there who were just fucking inquisitive. And to this day, and many of them have gone on to great things. Many of them actually went into work in AstraZeneca. Right. In fact, you included for some time, right?
Yeah.
And have carved out career paths where they're roundly recognised as incredible innovators. Mm. And look, again, like I say, you put the CVs down and go, oh, you've got a 24-year-old whippersnapper in here. Yeah. What are you doing? You know, what are you charging us this for? And it was, we never, ever, ever got a reaction from a client about, we're concerned about, you know, the seniority of these people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. These are juniors, you know. Because again, it was so transparent, the process. They would be in our innovation space, they would be working with us, but they understood from day one that the brains who were there thinking were all there to think in radically different ways.
Yeah.
And the bias there, if there was a bias in any respect, was our senior level of, you know, more seasoned professionals, if you want to call them that, were coaches.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And at our very best, you know, they were a trusted like set of ears and eyes.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't directing.
Yeah,
like, I would go away for a week. And Alex, you can be testament to this. Like, I'd go away for a week, go to the States, go around the client side of things, you know, meet partners, meet, you know, potential businesses we were going to do things with, get on a flight back on Thursday night. And Friday, I would make a point. I wouldn't go home, even though I lived in West London.
Mm-hmm.
I'd land in Heathrow, have a shower there, or shower in the office, come in, make sure I was there for our Friday stand-up.
Right.
So going back to Richard.
It's always had beers, isn't it?
Always had beers and fridges open. So the important thing was every product owner got up on a Friday in front of our entire team. Everybody stopped working and we shared our stories about what happened.
Yeah.
And I made a point of making sure that I could be back. And it was so rare, and you can be testament to this, Alex, so rare that I would ever miss one of those things.
Yeah.
I would literally travel all the way back across London from Heathrow to make sure I made it so that we could have those.
So basically, never let it be said there's a party that Prez isn't in the middle of.
Yeah, excellent.
But so just to summarise there for you, senior executive buy-in, huge.
Yeah.
Level of contact, faith, the belief in finding the right question to answer. And again, back to data and AI, the number of projects, right, and innovation, the number of projects where people don't sweat the fucking question hard enough.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy. And I see this all over the world in AI right now, especially the world of generative AI.
Yeah.
It's like, look at what it can do.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, marshmallow pictures. It's like, oh, great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And how many people are going to buy that?
Yeah.
And what is it actually worth? It was find what's worth attacking.
Yeah, yeah.
Find the problem that's worthy enough of this level of investment to go and solve for it, and then have a crack at it.
It's just so interesting to me because we've spent many, many moons with people doing exactly that. It's like you're asking some semi-hard questions here, but if you want to get value, you know, we've got to dig around on the questions first. We can run off and do a bunch of stuff for you, or what does the data tell me? Well, but that's not going to help you as much as, well, what's the problem you need to solve? What's the data we should be getting? And then what do you want it to
What's your hypothesis?
You know, go from there. And some people go to it, some people don't. You know, the thing is, there's always an investment, right? Because people go, all right, get you guys in. What are you telling me? What should we do now? We're saying, well, hold on, tell us the problem. Well, here's a problem. I spent a minute telling you that. Yeah, we need a bit more than a minute. Well, no, but you guys are supposed to give me the answer. Yeah. But if you want a good answer, you've got to spend a good amount of time helping to define the question, thinking a little bit beyond the obvious.
That's it.
And then we're going to come back to you with a few, you know, pointers, and then we're going to come back again. Why do I need to invest that much time? Because otherwise you're not going to get a good answer. So it's, you know, it's so refreshing to hear that. And what's really interesting there, and really key by the sounds of it, is like the massive investment to make that happen.
Yeah.
and often often we don't get it because there isn't any investment. Well, why should I give my time to you guys? This is just a side project for me. My boss isn't giving me anything extra for this.
You know?
You're
guys.
Just imposing on my time. But for a company to go, all right, actually, we're going to spend a lot of money on this. So therefore, it's well worth spending the time with these guys, no matter what it is, to come up with a better problem.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it almost turns it on its head. And it does sound like you had that whole, you know, there's a Skunk Works thing going.
Yeah.
There's, like you say, there's the buy-in, there's the innovation thinking, there's, right, we're going to have some different thinkers in here.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, the thing I love, and you spoke about also, is, you know, well, now we're looking, how can we use data differently? And here we are, what is it, 15 years plus later?
Yeah.
And we're still looking at companies going, is this what people are doing?
10 years ago, I guess it was, wasn't it? In fact, I think it was the 10th anniversary last year.
Right, so was it,
And it doesn't feel like that was it, because that, of course, that was the beginning of big data. Now, big data, as you said earlier, don't hear much about data lately, but sort of almost come and gone. Yeah. Or maybe it's just part of the layering, the infrastructure now, part of the furniture, yet people really saying, what data can I use to help understand where I'm, not just measure, and how can I use that to innovate, or how can I use that to test where I might go next?
Yeah.
And it still feels so little of that around. It still feels that's quite a major step for a lot of companies to have to take.
Yeah, well, I think it's just, it's never, the job's never done.
Yeah.
And I think that's very hard to build into that's a cultural thing.
Mm.
Right. And that is, you've got to keep fueling that culture. Now, I will be the first to admit, I think by the time we reached year three, the efficiency that we could run that process through was way better than the first years. And you never get away from a first year hang up where people go, bloody hell, that was that expensive place, wasn't it? Where they did whatever. I really emphasize again, our exec sponsors never threw shaders about that. They never went, poor, look at all this money that you've cost us and what have we got to show for it, kind of thing. Because frankly, in year one, there wasn't a lot of product that went live in earnest, right? But they never, they knew and understood that that was not how the innovation cycle happened.
Yeah.
And then you also knew and understood that the byproduct of culturally shifting the business to behave differently around innovation in data, innovation in marketing and so on, had a greater net effect and impact to the business that was intangible but incredibly valuable, was another reason why it carried that faith through. And again, I'm going to tie together two parts of our conversation quickly in the BT days, right?
Mm.
So again, when BT was renowned as being a very conservative business and one with very, very stringent and frankly unconstructive like processes, right? You know, like the release cycles. You know, the release cycles were quarterly for the dot-coms.
Oh, yes.
Quarterly release cycles. Like, what the fuck, right? You want a new feature? Yeah, it goes in 3 months' time. Right?
Yeah, and then gets knocked out by something else and you've got another 3 months' wait.
There you go, right? Yeah. And all these ludicrous things. So one of the things when we had the BT account, that was BT Consumer, we sold in a process by way of two fundamentals, right? One was, we would change everything in the presentation layer of the site without affecting the underlying code base.
Mm-hmm.
So we're essentially reskinning the site by stealth and changing the user journeys and everything like that in the presentation layer versus the back end. So we didn't have to go through what was called the CCP release cycle. Massive value back to the business in terms of agility, in terms of what we could do. And then we could communicate back into the business to try and make some more fundamental changes. So that was there. And the second thing was cultural. And again, the backing of the clients, we said, we need greater proximity with your business to understand the impact of what we're doing, number one. Number two, you need greater proximity with our business because we will help change you culturally.
Yeah.
And the clients went as far as going, right, our commitment is our teams spend at least half of their time inside your business. Now, obviously, as an agency, a lot of agencies get quite uncomfortable with that. They go, oh, clients can be around the business all the time. And we were like, done. Passes, everything. Yeah. You have access to everything in our business in the same way as we will have it for you. And it was an unbelievable partnership. So I credit, like, especially in my career, the relationship building that we did by thinking differently in the likes of a BT relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
And then translating that into an AstraZeneca relationship and understanding how important, right, culturally,
yeah,
how we brief teams, you know, yes, you are going to have clients sitting among us.
Yeah.
And, but by the way, they're part of the team.
Yeah.
Yes, clients, you're going to be sitting among our teams. But by the way, you need to understand culturally at times there are things that we just don't do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, as a suit, I certainly don't sit on the shoulder of my team and go, pixel fuck that there and push this there and what are you doing here? Da, da, da. That's an absolute no-no in our business.
Yeah.
So with respect, you can't behave like that amongst our teams.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, creating those cultural norms was really, really important.
Yeah.
But at the same time as well, it then it created a really shared ownership of the problems, the outcomes and everything.
Yeah.
And it also changed each other's culture. Like our teams for BT and AstraZeneca cared so much about what the impact of that work was going to be. It wasn't you finished the project and went, right, I'm off to fucking find the next pitch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
See you later.
Yeah.
You know, clients would be stopped in corridors and literally, like, my client Sam Calvert, shout out to Sam, stopped me going to the office once and he's like, am I going to put on a really bad Aussie accent? No. I just had the best conversation I've ever had with an agency, with a member of an agency team. I was like, really? Who's that? And he goes, Dom, who's our lead creative at the time, had just done, you know, a whole bunch of work on this and led a bunch of creative work. And I was like, why is that? What were you talking about? He goes, he just asked me what broadband sales we've done this week as a result of the new work going live. And I was like, okay. And he goes, mate, the creatives don't ask us that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They've got a campaign live and, you know, it's eyeballs, it's whatever, it's something like that. But he literally stopped me and went, did sales go up?
Yeah.
Did it work? Have we made an impact? Have we? And that was in the DNA of our teams who worked on those types of programs. So yeah, but yeah, back to that like innovation process and data's role in it.
Yeah.
I think what's fundamental is data was upfront in many forms. Ethnographic data, cultural data, health economics data. You know, Alex and I, the project that we worked on was called Deeply. Neither of us, I believe, were involved in the initial ideation process. Again, shout out to Chris Downs, who was the product owner for that. An amazing data thinker and innovator. And conceptually, though, they'd conceptualized what the potential of overlaying genomic data with healthcare records could potentially present early. I would hold back on saying diagnosis because it's an overused word, but prediction that you could potentially have a presentation of a given condition. And they were looking in the rare disease space, right?
Yeah.
And so they picked a pathway for one condition called Behçet's. And in a kind of a controlled manner, worked out that had certain presentations been spotted in the health records, and patterns in the health record, the person who was suffering from that Behçet's condition could have been diagnosed, was it 10 years earlier or something like that?
Wow.
Which is life-changing, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they'd done it on a one-to-one basis, right? So they'd gone, look, here is it. Now, you could argue, oh, well, that's fake it till you make it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But really, again, I respect the research that they'd done before that. They had gone, there are a number of conditions where this could be true because the patterns that appear for those conditions are common, right? But it's only when certain things line up. And by the way, those things line up more frequently than we might know if we can just sort out the data.
Yeah.
Granted, the sorting out of the data is something we don't quite know enough about, but manually, here's what we've proven with this small cohort. Give us some investments so we can go and prove more. So that's where Alex and I came in to the kind of project build team to then go, right, there's a small amount of data and research that's been done around this. There's a nascent customer experience that's being built. Let's make stuff. And so then we were given, frankly, one of the best projects I think I've ever, in my professional career, I've had the pleasure to work on. I was coming into Dig at the time to join the board, and Hugo said to me, I was like, what's the fastest way of me getting my head into healthcare? I've never really worked in healthcare before. And he goes, you're going to be a product owner. What? And he goes, yep, you're going to be on the board, but you're going to be a product owner at the same time. And you're going to take Deeply.
Wow.
And I had literally two weeks of sheet dipping into healthcare data, genomics. Alex and I got our heads together. We brought in Critton and Liz.
Yeah,
we were like a small team.
At medical conferences. Yeah. I mean, what the hell was that about? I didn't know what they were talking about, those words. They were in English, didn't know what any of them meant.
Many were in Latin.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
We went and met healthcare systems. We went and met the healthcare platform providers to understand what data they had. I had a meeting with the head of Genomics England. I hadn't been on the project 6 weeks. I sat down with the head of Genomics England and explained what we were doing. And at that time, he'd amber lit us having access to the Human Genome Project, which at the time, when you think about it now, we met them when they had, I think it was like several hundred patients in the Human Genome Project, which is now hundreds of thousands of records, right?
Yeah.
But at that point, we managed to get, again, back to don't fake it, make something. You know, don't fake, make.
Yeah.
And so I credit all of the product teams with having that ethos, right? Because every single time we were like, right, how do we find the data? Or how do we find the cohort of patients? Or how do we find like the ethnographic approach? Whatever it is, that's going to be able to take us through to the next gate.
Yeah.
Because at the next gate, we have to go and go, right, we need this much money to get to this next thing. And here are our hypotheses that we're trying to prove. And here are the signals that we're looking for. And if we come back and we miss any of those signals, then we can pull the plug.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So to summarize, I mean, it's quite an epic journey. Right? So I hear a lot of reduce friction, right? So almost the most important thing that you achieved is reduce friction in the overall process and then reduce the natural friction. And this goes for BT and probably some other stuff as well. The natural friction that happens in that dark zone between the client and the agency or the consultancy or whatever, right? And that reduced friction with regards to communication. So once you've got that, you know, nicely lubricated, I don't know, conduit.
Yeah.
Then you need momentum, which was provided by the process, which had constant strong impetus to prove value.
Yes.
And then it was just having the right people and giving them the resources and the knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. Or the ability to gain that.
Yeah.
And there was no, that begs no innovation, mm-hmm. right? You got a sausage meat on one end or just meat of the sausage machine.
Mm-hmm.
You're not necessarily getting sausages out the other side, right? I've tried. I got a horrible mess, right? It's just like slop that was not edible. So, And you might get your fingers stuck in. So I think what we're saying here is there's a certain degree to which build it and the innovation will come. But I think there was more magic going on here, especially, well, not least the other massive important factor was buy-in from proper senior people. This was top down to bottom up rather than, you know, grassroots.
Yeah.
And that all of these things had to be in place for innovation to happen in that type of environment. If you think about a startup or something like that, it's a hard life, but you can be innovative because you naturally, all of those things are close together anyway, right? So your CEO is also one of your programmers and, you know, your wife's joining in and all that, you know, your dog is in the office. And there's just so little friction and there's a lot of momentum and there's a lot of impetus because if we don't deliver this, we're all out of a job. and all that investment has gone, right? And the VCs are going to hit us on the head, right?
But just on that point, though, Alex, in that environment, the direction, the North Star, can be totally off, right?
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that really helped us in DIG was both the clients but also our own people were a brilliant check and balance to that North Star. So because we had this kind of pseudo, we called them investment gates. You used the word investment, actually, mate, and actually they were called investment gates. It wasn't a board meeting.
Yeah.
It was an investment gate.
Right. So
each month you would go and report to get through an investment gate, right? And at the investment gates, we would present and then make a case either for progressing or against. What was interesting for us as an experience in Deeply was we were 4 months into it. I mean, it's amazing what we covered in 4 months. I mean, we'd got sample data which had been given to us in anonymized fashion via a connected, what's called a connected PCT, then a connected primary care trust.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 17,000 records that we were given access to. And then we had some genomic data that we placed alongside that. And we were basically hiding faked records, essentially, for these patients,
yeah,
inside of there, and then simulating whether our algorithmic approach could find them. So it was like a timeline. So imagine we knew that we'd hidden them, we knew they existed.
Yeah.
But the model itself, so I'm pointing at the desk. But at that point in time, we would then simulate essentially Back to the Future. So send the algorithm, because it wasn't an AI back then.
No.
Of course, now we'd have badged it as an AI.
Oh, of course. We've
probably got like 25 million to carry on with the project. But then it was just plain machine learning.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And anyway, we basically rolled back the timeline in the patient record, for want of a better term,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then you sit effectively with the algorithm listening as we then simulated the data accumulating over time.
Yeah.
So the patient records featuring these facets that would appear.
Yeah.
And then there were loads of false positives, there were loads of other things there, but the algorithm never knew the existence of those records in that pattern. And then we would wait for the like microwave bing. Or in fact, it wasn't a microwave bing, it would be Alex wandering over through DIG with his laptop open and just going, found it! Found it!
Excellent.
Doom! And then exploding this graph on the wall. So we take that, but then we went to an investment gate. Sorry to bring it back to the point and go, right, so here's our recommendation. Here's what we're doing. I've sat down with Genomics England. This is what's happening. Alex has got these amazing results. And we flipped to our last slide and went, so our recommendation is we need to stop the project. And I'm getting goosebumps now. Literally, you can see this, guys, just even talking about that moment.
Yeah.
Because the room, the tension in the room at that moment, but also like just the atmosphere in the room at that time was just like nothing I've ever felt. Because everyone, we built up to this crescendo.
Like,
we've found this, we've done that, we've done the other, we've done this. Bang, 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 tick, tick, tick. And we're telling you, you need to stop. And they were like, what?
It's like the exact opposite you'll ever get from an agency and consultancy. Right, goes, you only need another 18 months at, you know, $1 million a month. You know what I mean?
We could have sat in that meeting and said to that executive team, and so here's how much we need, and this is what we need to do, and this is what it is. And they sat and went, well, how much is it to carry on?
Right.
We do have a number, but we're not. The number that we're going to show you like takes us out to like 6 months' time. So we've done all the calculations for it. But what we're saying to you is, you shouldn't do this. This, you organisationally are not the right vehicle for this to happen with.
Right. Okay.
And we believe, as much as we personally would be interested in doing this, and it is amazing, and we all as a team, God, we've been through the ringer. I mean, like, it was a very emotional project as well, because it was so challenging and so mind melding. But on a personal basis, it was the hardest thing to ever do, to go into that room and go, we don't think you should back this. Because it almost felt like we were saying, we don't think you should back us.
Betrayal.
Yeah. and when it came to it, back to that data point, your data was part of our proof point.
Yeah.
It was to say, look, the horizon for the investment and what you'd need to do, and actually some of the catch-up some of these technologies would need, we would need to spend months and months carrying on, talking to the healthcare systems, talking to the records, continuing to build and simulate. But for us to get to a meaningful level of data access and anything like that, you're probably talking 12 to 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that's millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, we can't say with any certainty, and this is a hard thing to say to a client as well, is you're not going to be able to sustain this.
Mm-hmm.
Because our job is not to be this business. It's not to be Deeply as a product. It is, we had what was called a graduation process in DIC, right? We were mandated that any product that we carried through a completion pathway had to graduate
mm-hmm.
back into the ownership of the core business of AstraZeneca, yeah, which yeah, again, from an innovation yeah. process, is a guardrail I think every single innovation program should have, mm-hmm. right? Because it's fucking responsibility yeah. on both fronts, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And we said, with any certainty, we cannot tell you that in 12 to 18 months' time, we believe organizationally you have the right structure for it, because it's so different. It's so outside of where you derive value today.
Yeah.
We just don't think you should do it. They insisted on us taking an initial month's budget, which actually went out by a couple of extra weeks, and it micro bits by them, because they were just like, can you just get that little few inches further along the road so you can wrap this up in the way that you'll be proud of and you'll be happy with, but also in a way that if we could ever pull it down off the shelf, we could pull it down again.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, unfortunately, I don't have any of that stuff anymore, because obviously we were bound by...
Yeah.
You know, and I respect all of those kind of conventions. Yeah. So I'd love to look back at it now. But the, you know, I think then... We'd done it on, like I say, a 17,000 patient record. Now, roll forward, was it 2 or 3 years? And I messaged you, and I was like, look at what Google's just done. And Google had been lauding a project that they'd done where they had examined, I think it was, they were the first project to have examined 10,000 patient records, was it, at the time? And find patterns of prediction for, I can't remember what condition it was.
Okay.
And like, 3 years before, maybe even 4 years before, we'd done it on 17,000 records,
yeah.
and in a much, much, like, a very harder classification of what we were trying to do.
Wow.
And we both, like, messaged feature the fact, just go, fuck it, we should have spun this off as a business. We should have tried to buy it off. But anyway, look, long and tall it is, like, a hard part of innovation is knowing when to stop.
Yeah.
And being responsible and go, what have we learned? How far has it got us? Is it enough?
Yeah.
And actually, can we be certain enough that conditions that we're creating together are going to deliver on the eventual investment? And again, you look at PE-backed businesses now and stuff like that, and how actually fucking irresponsible so many of those businesses are in the way they can.
Yeah, we can only hope that,
produce product.
All of Silicon Valley are on listening. Yeah, did you hear that, Silicon Valley?
We're going to get hired by you lot because we actually want businesses that deliver.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it seems antithetical to the whole, you know, capitalist ethos. People did think we were nuts. Like, you know, here's my perfectly healthy dog. I'm going to take it out the back now and shoot it. Right? And it was just like, no, you know, guys, it didn't make any sense. But it was all the fun. Yes, it was. Man, we haven't even scratched the surface, because there's a whole episode after that as well.
Yeah.
with a very, very, very bad night in Tokyo.
there was your client action.
There was karaoke, and there was karaoke in fancy dress. Yeah, in the same bar as Lost in Translation.
Oh, okay.
Oh God, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah. We're not going there.
Well, finding a photo on my phone the next day, and I looked at this picture, and I was like, when did I meet Pikachu? Hang on. I am Pikachu. I was almost like setting the trend at the time for how people of the youth of today like to take pictures of themselves in the bathroom. I basically clearly went to the bathroom, looked up and went, oh, right, I'm Pikachu. Took a photo of myself and then forgot about it. Yeah, and then the next day I'm in the queue to get on the plane. And I looked at it and went, when the fuck was I Pikachu? Excellent. And the guys in the queue next to me were just like, Prez, don't you remember, like, Adam, our client, was dressed as a penguin, and then you were chasing him down the street in this Pikachu costume.
This is in central Tokyo.
The middle of Roppongi or whatever.
Like probably like 1 a.m. So that's been another day. So look, we haven't. There is so much more here, and I also feel like we haven't even. I mean, there's a lot to drill down there just on the rudiments of what you're talking about, what we're discussing here. And so I wonder whether or not we're going to come back and do this. And we had an amazing conversation earlier between four of us, I should say to the listeners, my 18-year-old son is sitting in the room, as teenagers do, with his face pointed at his mobile phone. but active participant in spirit. Say hello.
Very active with us earlier when we were having our debates on.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Say hello, Joe.
Hello.
I threatened to try and cut bits out of that conversation earlier on and add them to this, or as a maybe an addendum. We'll have to see how we get on, but no doubt we'll do this again.
Yes.
Because I feel like there's unfinished business here, but I think we have to wrap it up because it's 10:30. Pete's got to go back to Essex. Is that Essex?
No, Hertfordshire.
Hertfordshire. Okay, it's a shire. from shire to shire. I've got to sleep. So, yes. Thank you.
Yes,
Prez.
Thank you so much, Prez.
Thank you very much, guys. Pleasure.
And we'll hopefully speak to you again. But in the meantime, bye, everybody.
Adios.
The Confusion Matrix.